From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's not easy to talk about race in America. It's weighed down with history and with the present. Michael Brown, the black incarceration rate, poverty. In his new book, The Sellout, author Paul Beatty has fun with it all, and critics are euphoric. His protagonist is a black farmer who grows pot, tries to segregate his town, and owns a slave who begs to be beaten. This hour on Point, author Paul Beatty and his sharp, rollicking take on race. You can join us on air or online. What's your response when we talk about a post-racial America? Are you ready for humor, for satire in our national conversation about race? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in the hour, we'll look at President Obama's visit to Selma, Alabama, to mark the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. Joining me now from New York is Paul Beatty. He's the author of Slumberland, Tough, and The White Boy Shuffle, and editor of Hokum, an anthology of African-American humor. His new book is The Sellout. The Los Angeles Times called it one of the most important and difficult American novels written in the 21st century. You can read an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Paul Beatty, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hello, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, congratulations on these wonderful reviews. I mentioned the Los Angeles Times. The Wall Street Journal calls it dazzling, satire of the highest order. New York Times critics said, I gave up underlining the killer bits because my arm began to hurt. They read like the most concussive monologues and interviews of Chris Rock, Richard Pryor, and Dave Chappelle wrapped in a satirical yet surprisingly delicate literary and historical sensibility. Very impressive. How does it feel to get such positive recognition?
It's good. A little nerve-wracking, but yeah, it's good.
It must be difficult to work very hard in a book and not be sure people will interpret it the right way. Was that ever a concern?
Yeah, I guess there's like little moments, not so much when I'm writing, more in like when I'm not writing. You know, I'll see something on television or something and I'll just like start cringing and going, what the hell am I doing? But I try not to think about it so much and just try to get what's in my head onto the page.
Well, the very first page of this book sets the tone for the novel. You write, quote, this may be hard to believe coming from a black man, but I've never stolen anything. And it goes on from there. That's the narrator whose last name is Mee. I want you to describe your protagonist and why you started the book the way that you did.
Who is the guy? I think at one point in the book he describes himself as his father's son, and his father is kind of is a social psychologist. And you know, when you, I don't know if you know any kids who are the progeny of a psychologist, but you know, they oftentimes try to put their theories to the test using their kids. And so his father has tried to like kind of construct like the his idea of what a young black man should be, and chiseled him out of nothing really. But and so he's got a kid who's very hyper aware, but is not exactly sure what to do with all the things he sees and all the stuff he knows. What else did you ask me? I'm sorry.
Well, and along the way, he picks up the label sellout. So the sellout is, of course, the title of the book. What does that label convey?
That conveys different things to different people, which is, I guess, kind of the point about, you know, what is a sellout and what happens if selling out is actually efficacious to what you're trying to do, you know? I don't know. I haven't read this book in a while, but there's no author in the book, but there's a book called like The American Directory of Uncle Toms, which I love that title. And it's kind of like a phone book of black Americans that, I don't know, this author, a group of whoever put the book together, feel that are Uncle Toms. My friend Lydia told me about it a long time ago. And and something I've always thought about for a long time is like, what is an Uncle Tom, you know, beyond the character in a book, you know, what is that like, who are those people, you know, it's so easy to dump on them. I don't know. And it's not necessarily a sympathetic kind of portrayal, but it's for me, it's just always interesting to who is when. And so one of these things in this book, I mean, the book's really thick, and it's got every single famous black person ever.
Yes,
you know? And
Tiger Woods, Clarence Thomas, Bill Cosby.
I mean, do you know this book? You're like the only other person other than Lydia who knows this book.
No.
So, yeah, but it's actually, you know, so I just, and, you know, you read the book, and there's people who, you know, you feel certain ways about.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it's just interesting. You know, it's about, you know, where that threshold is of being a traitor, being a whatever. I don't know.
So the Sellout tells the story of a place called Dickens, California, which is a very poor neighborhood on the edge of Los Angeles. Tell us a little bit about Dickens. What kind of place is this? Yeah.
Dickens, I don't know. I mean, it is. I mean, it's, you know, it's seen as a ghetto. It's a rough place. I mean, the character is rough and violent in a different sense of rough and violence, I think, than we're used to talking about. But it's, you know, like California is kind of an agrarian place, you know, and you don't always think about it. You know, it depends where you live. But this is a section of L.A. which is like zoned for farming, and there's horses. People own goats, and, you know, they graze their animals in the median, in the street median, chickens in the streets. And so it's kind of based on a real place in L.A., actually. Yeah, so it's a strange neighborhood in a weird way that neighborhood, at least to me, feels strange.
And one day Dickens is unceremoniously erased from maps,
right,
as part of a, quote, blatant conspiracy by the surrounding increasingly affluent two-car garage community to keep their property values up, end quote.
Yeah.
And in response, your protagonist sets off on a campaign to reestablish the most reprehensible elements of American racism? Is that about right? Tell us what happened.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends how you define reprehensible. He's just trying to do it the best way he knows how, I guess. And so,
well, he segregates the schools. He takes a slave, right?
Yeah.
That's just for starters.
Yeah. So he doesn't take a slave. He kind of, I don't know. His slave is kind of like double-sided tape. It just refuses to go anywhere. But, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles. And so, I mean, I don't live there now. But, you know, like, I used to always have a hard time answering the question where I was from. You know, sometimes shame, sometimes embarrassment. But often, because my neighborhood never had a name, you know. But, you know, now, like, property values have, like, changed in L.A. and L.A., you know, real estate is everything. Maybe it's always been, but, you know, so I'll be driving around and, you know, I'll look up and, you know, it'll say Crestview, you know, so there are all these little neighborhoods around my neighborhood that suddenly have names, you know, to give them some kind of cachet. And it's just so weird to me. And at some point I just, you know, and my neighborhood has a name now, which I would never call it that. It just doesn't feel right, you know? And so it's, for me, it's just interesting how that, like, a place name shapes your identity and, you know, where you're from and how you see yourself. And I just, I don't know, at some point, I'm kind of lying here, so bear with me. But at some point, it was interesting to me of, like, what happens when where you're from has been erased, you know? Hmm. Like, where the house you grew up in and your parents no longer live there, you know, where do you go? How do you feel? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Just where's your little...
Where's your world?
Focal point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And so I just... That just grew increasingly interesting to me. And the other thing is, you know, little basic things. Like, I love cartography. I love looking at maps and, you know, just these little things, you know, about how at least I locate myself in the world.
So a lot of writers would shy away from discussions of race when it includes humor. And there's so much of that in this book. I'm curious, has it always been comfortable for you to integrate those two?
No, it's extremely uncomfortable.
Because it's throughout the book.
It's very, I mean, writing's uncomfortable. Writing about the things I write about, the way I write about them is uncomfortable. I mean, I'm always uncomfortable. So that's just part of it. You know, but through that, I try to talk about, like, that sense of comfort and stuff. And, you know, in a weird way, I admire people that are comfortable, you know, because I just don't know how to do it. So it's not a matter of being easy or hard. It's, you know, the process is hard. Life is hard. Writing's hard. You know, it's just hard work, period. It doesn't matter what you're writing about. And so, you know, I don't know. I guess I disagree. I think people have always looked at race with a lot of humor, you know. I think the you know, the things have changed about like where that humor is coming from and who's it being directed towards and who's delivering the joke. That's changed over time, in a way, I guess. So I don't think that's like anything new necessarily.
One critic said that, quote, almost the entirety of Black American culture and stereotypes are carved up under this novel's microscope. Will you be specific and tell us, to your mind, what were some of the more stereotypical characters or scenes from this book?
that's tough. What's a stereotype? I mean, I don't think that they're, I mean, they are stereotypical, but I try to, you know, turn them inside out. So there's a, I don't know, the scene that just pops into mind is when the school has already been segregated by race, even though all the students are, you know, pretty much all Latino and Black, you know, but for whatever reason, the school's achievement scores have gone up. And so the school is now getting, you know, reintegrated by like these, I guess, this brave phalanx of white students who want to enroll in the school. So it's just kind of me mocking. And this is for me in a stereotypical image, but like these things like Little Rock and these kind of images are just for me stereotypical in the way that we talk about integration and segregation in this, you know, at least here, at least in school or, you know, in the paper, whatever. So it's, I understand why we do it that way, but it's always so narrow, that focus about how we look at it. So that's me just trying to like twist it inside it out a little bit.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Paul Beatty, author of the critically acclaimed new book, The Sellout, about race, about slavery, about segregation. Paul Beatty, author of Slumberland Tough, The White Boy Shuffle. His new book, as I mentioned, is called The Sellout. John has a question here from Nashville, Tennessee. John, glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
Hey there, Jane. Actually, I just wanted to say, number one, that I was not familiar with Mr. Beatty, and I will get the book and read it. I'm really looking forward to it. And as I told the young lady when I called in, I'm a baby boomer, okay? I'm a white guy. I'm a baby boomer. I live in Nashville, Tennessee. And my observation and experience is that there's all too many people that fit my demographic that take their race so seriously, and that keeps, I'm serious, I mean it. And one of my closest friends is a Black lady in Columbus, Ohio, who thinks she's my mom, and I love it. And we have conversations, and whenever we do, we make fun of race because race doesn't define either one of us. And so we can have a good time with all the white stereotypes and all the Black stereotypes because the white stereotypes are coming out of my mouth and the Black stereotypes are coming out of hers. And then every once in a while we actually do get down to reality.
John, thank you very much. Paul Beatty, respond.
I guess I know where he's coming from. And I don't know. I can't remember where I saw this, but I remember I've seen an image about some Klansman. Guy was in the Klan. This is a while ago, like in the 80s. I don't know if he was in the Klan in the 80s. Anyways, but he was talking about his best friend, you know, who he felt was his best friend, which was a Black guy, you know. And it really flipped me out at some level. Like, what is he thinking about? Like, how is this working, you know? And, you know, it's not my place to tell him who his friends are and who can like him and how he sees this, but you know, it's, and I by no means want to equate John with, just because he's from Tennessee and speaks in a dialect that, you know, identifies with this. But, you know, like, we make decisions, like, in a weird way, like, what we think makes sense doesn't make sense. Like, here in New York, I don't know when this was, I guess in the mid-90s, there was this case of these cops, I think it was in Brooklyn maybe, abusing this Black man. I mean, they just completely abused the Abner Louima case. Mm-hmm. And me and another writer friend of mine, I don't want to say her name, just savor the embarrassment, were reading all this stuff. I mean, everything was just insane racial invective and slander. And they defiled the guy in so many ways, you know, violently. And we're reading this, and we both said, you know, mutually of each other, it's like, I bet you this cop has a black girlfriend, you know? And it turned out he did, but there was just something in how we were reading it that was like, he's, you know, I don't know why people do what they do, but there was just something that just didn't make sense about it. And yeah, I mean, you know, I don't have like an answer to this. And, you know, it's...
Well,
it's,
maybe the broader question here is, what's your response, Paul Beatty, when people talk about a post-racial America?
Yeah, I don't know what that means. I mean, I don't pay too much attention to it. You know, I kind of mock it because I don't know what it means. You know, I just don't, you know. And I mean, I think, look, there's a need to want to feel good about where you live and who you are and how you think and that you're smart, that you're considerate, that you're kind and all this and that, you know, and that, you know, people move forward, you know, and so I understand where that comes from. And then there also within that, you know, things do change at some level, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm not a person who reads a ton of academic journals or reads all these things where people try to, you know, define these phrases. You know, then these phrases make their way into, you know, mainstream conversation at some level. So I don't know. There's a section in the book where, you know, one of the characters, Hominy, who's the old child actor, the last living Little Rascals, and they're talking about post-racial, post-soul and all this. He goes, I don't know what the hell you guys are talking about. You know, I'm pre-black. That's it. You know what I mean? And there's a lot about that kind of sentiment that I agree with. You know, mm-hmm. How you define black, that might change over time, but it's still black.
Will you read a passage from the book? This page 146. This is where 146, where Bon Bon hopes to find Dickens' sister city.
Okay, sure. When Mrs. Susan Silverman, city match consultant, called about my application, I couldn't have been more excited. Hello, we're happy to have processed your application for International Municipal Sisterhood, but we can't seem to find Dickens on the map. It's near Los Angeles, right? We used to be in an official city, but now it's kind of occupied territory like Guam, American Samoa, or the Sea of Tranquility. So you're near the ocean? Yes, an ocean of sorrow. Well, it doesn't matter that you're not a recognized city. Sister City Global has paired communities before. For instance, Harlem, New York's sister city, is Florence, Italy, because of their respective renaissances. Dickens hasn't had a renaissance, has it? No, we haven't even had a single day of enlightenment. That's too bad, but I do wish I'd known that you were a coastal community because that makes a difference. But as it were, I ran your demographics through Urbana, our matchmaking computer, and it came back with three prospective sisters. I grabbed my atlas and tried to guess who would be the lucky ladies. I knew better than to expect Rome, Nairobi, Cairo, or Kyoto, but I figured second-tier hotties like Naples, Leipzig, and Canberra were definitely in play. Let's see, your three sister cities in order of compatibility, Juarez, Chernobyl, and Kinshasa. Well, I didn't quite understand how Chernobyl had made the cut, especially since it's not even a city. At least Juarez and Kinshasa were two major municipalities with global profiles, if not besmirched reputations. But beggars can't be choosy. We'll accept all three, I shouted into the phone. That's all well and good, but I'm afraid all three have rejected Dickens. What? Why? On what grounds? Juarez, a.k.a. the city that never stops bleeding, feels that Dickens is too violent. Chernobyl, why tempted, felt that in the end, Dickens' proximity to the Los Angeles River and sewage treatment plants was a problem, and questioned the attitudes of a citizenry so laissez-faire about such rampant pollution. And Kinshasa, of the Democratic Republic of Congo? Don't tell me. Kinshasa, the poorest city in the poorest country in the world, a place where the average per capita income is one goat bell, two bootleg Michael Jackson cassette tapes, and three sips of potable water per year, thinks we're too poor to associate with. No, they think Dickens is too black.
The protagonist in the book, Bon Bon, as I mentioned, segregates the schools, calls it localized apartheid. Do you see America as segregated? Where are we in this country, to your mind, on this point?
I have a hard time talking in these generalizations. I guess that's why I write. So, I mean, I guess it depends. What do you mean by segregated? I mean, look, you know, I'm from L.A. It's a very segregated place. You can go to neighborhoods and you know, the majority of people are of one color. But like in my neighborhood, which is kind of integrated, you know, the public schools are 99% Latino. So I don't know how that works and what kind of segregation that is. I had sushi last night and I was looking at the sushi chefs, and for a second I thought one of them was a woman, and I went, wait, I've never seen a female sushi chef. Like, you know, is that segregation? Is that discrimination? I watched The Bachelor, this reality show. Is that segregation? Is that discrimination? Is that, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't know. And, it depends how deeply you want to focus that microscope. You know, do you want to look at it 10x, or you want to use an electron microscope to look at it? You know, look, the president's black, you know, what does that say? You know? So, yeah, I have a trouble. I'm just not good at finding like these kind of answers for those kind of questions, if that makes any sense. But, you know, I still want to try to answer it. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, people have a long way to go.
Let's go to Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Carl. Welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Great segment, I'm telling you. Your guess is much too modest, so I guess I'll walk out on that uncomfortable ledge. Post-racial, this is what it means. A segment of the white population in America said, okay, America has elected a black president, so racism and the sins of the past 400 years is over with. Get over it, black people. That's what post-racial means. One of the biggest problems that we have with discussing race in our country is the difficultness of even just thinking the unthinkable was done to a particular race of people, black people in this country, is so unbelievable and so ugly and horrible that it's hard for people to even just talk about it. Another thing is we've been taught here in America, black kids and white kids and every other race, to look at black people as two-dimensional. We were slaves, we were freed, we were given the rights to vote, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, end of story. When in fact, black people on this planet have a huge, huge history. One more example, my son, I remember when he was in the sixth grade, he came home with this shocked look on his face that most of the children in his class, I think it was in the seventh grade, most of the children other than him and one other little girl didn't know that Egypt was in Africa. The rich history of Egypt is African history, black history, and they were unaware of this. So until we start teaching our children that, yes, black people on this planet are three-dimensional, we're not just slaves in Rosa Parks, we will never have a comfortable conversation of race in this country.
Carl, thank you. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it very much. John is in West Hartford, Connecticut. John, welcome to you. Hello.
Hi, Jane. I just had a quick question for Mr. Bethany. I wonder if he's ever concerned about the fact, I haven't read the book, so I'll just put that out there, but I wonder if he's concerned about the fact that some of his humor might be taken the way that Dave Chappelle had a problem with his act, and the reason why he's not doing his show anymore, what I call the Chappelle effect, which is where a particular ethnicity jokes about themselves publicly, and then another ethnicity takes and appropriates those jokes to reinforce stereotypes and discrimination that they already hold in their breast. And I'll take the answer off the air.
John, thank you. Paul Beatty, go ahead.
Yeah, I like what I'm glad Carl said what he said. I mean, you know, at some level, I agree with that. I'm sorry, I don't remember the last caller's name.
John.
Also, but John. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the post-racial thing, I agree with what he said, but it's also people, there are black people who really want to believe in that, too. Like, there's a part in the book where there's a character who kind of rewrites all these racist novels, like Huckleberry Finn, you know, and that's a book that has the word in it like a jillion times, and he's rewriting it, and he replaces that word with I can't remember what the word is, the warrior, and he replaces the word slave with dark-skinned volunteer. You know, and that comes from a person who I know, like talking about like how uncomfortable he is reading that book to his kids. And for me, it's like, I mean, I don't know. Part of that thing is, it's hard for me to talk about this. Like, I think part of it, it's not about being comfortable or not, but it's talking about how uncomfortable it is, you know, and just being straightforward and how, you know, and that's not necessarily that's going to lead to something, but it's like a basis for, like, you know, and there's a sense of, like, you know, like people, the nation has just never taken any kind of accountability for these things. And, like, that there's always a timeline when these things are over. Well, we don't need affirmative action. It's over, you know. And, you know, there's this phrase, the sins of the fathers. And, you know, but and sometimes you do stuff that's so heinous, so egregious, it's just going to last forever, you know. And it's how are we going to manage that? And manage is like the worst word to use. I don't know. I can't just think of a better word, you know. But
then right now, then, Paul Beatty, which political figures, which government figures, arts figures and the like do you see helping America with its conversation?
I think a lot of people are trying to help, you know, whether I agree with them. It's not up to me to just say, oh, this person's helping, this person's not helping. I mean, I say that stuff all the time, you know, but I have a problem saying that in public, really, you know.
Because a lot of people say President Obama has shied away from talking about race.
Yeah. So and I don't want to forget about this last thing about the Dave Chappelle thing. So, like, let's take Obama. So the first thing Obama does as president is he gives that speech in that park in Chicago, like kind of his acceptance speech. So I remember watching that, and you know, he starts telling this story about this older woman. I don't know, she's 106 or something, and he says her name. I remember her last name is Nixon or something like that. She was born at a time where women he was born at a time where women, and at least in the feed I was watching, the camera cuts to a black woman who's like kind of feels like she knows what Obama's going to say. And Obama says, and she was born at a time when women, and the woman says, women and black people couldn't vote. But Obama goes, women and people of color, of people of her skin color or something, couldn't vote. And for me, it's like a subtle, small difference, but it is a weird difference about how you're talking about what's really happening. You know what I mean? So he never says that this woman is African-American or black. He never says this. You know, there's all this code about how we're going to assume who she is. You know, I'm pretty sure she is black, you know, but it's interesting about, like, little subtle dodges that you take. And I remember an early thing that he talked about where they're talking about the White House dog or something, you know, and trying to get a dog that's, like, non-allergenic. And Obama calls himself a mutt, you know, and I guess people got up in a roar. I'm not sure how I feel about it, but it's something I think about, you know, about when do you say these things? Who are you talking to? You know, and for me, I read these things as the president. He's not talking to me when he's saying the mutt thing. It's not a thing that, you know, mutts don't say to other mutts or whatever, you know. It's a thing that you say to the pure breed people, whoever those people are, in a weird way. It's just weird about, like, who's talking to who about way or about race and how we're addressing it, you know. And yeah, I'm going to tell the guy how to talk about it. I'm sure he has tons of things. It's about when he feels he can say these things.
We're talking with Paul Beatty about race and his new book, getting incredible reviews, called The Sellout. We'll go out with That's Why They Call Me Shine, from the 1943 film Cabin in the Sky, sung by John W. Bubbles. The song is about a man named Shine who was beaten during the New York City race riot of 1900. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I always wear a smile and suits to dress up in the latest style. Gee, I'm glad I'm living. Why take troubles all with a smile? Just because my color's shady, a wee bit different maybe, that's why they call me shy.
Hi everybody, Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking with Paul Beatty about his new book, The Sellout, this hour, and you can join the conversation. What do you make of Paul Beatty's story of a pot-growing farmer who owns a slave and wants to resegregate his town? Paul Beatty is the author of the highly acclaimed new book, The Sellout. Paul, read a little bit more for us, page 22 of The Sellout. You're talking here about the dynamics between a black Supreme Court justice and your main character, your protagonist, yeah. Bon-Bon.
Fisk has barely uttered, "May it please the court." That's his the guy's Supreme Court lawyer.
When so the set, black set justice, this up for us, though, Paul. He's in court
yeah.
because.
Well, so he's the book opens up in the Supreme Court, yeah, because you know he's done all these things and. That are, people feel might be unconstitutional. But he's done these things that are unconstitutional that have had the odd effect of achieving what these constitutional things were supposed to achieve, if that makes any sense. So everybody's trying to figure out, like, how has all this worked. Fisk has barely uttered, "May it please the court," when the black justice moves almost imperceptibly forward in his seat. No one would have noticed, but a squeaky wheel on his swivel chair gave him away. And with each referral to some obscure section of the Civil Rights Act or precedent-setting case, the justice shifts imperceptibly, impatiently, causing his chair to squeak louder and louder with each transfer of his restless body weight from one flabby, diabetic butt cheek to the other. You can assimilate the man, but not the blood pressure. And the vein pulsating angrily down the middle of his forehead gives him away. He's giving me that crazy, red-eyed, penetrating look that back home we call the Willowbrook Avenue stare. Willowbrook Avenue being the four-lane River Styx that in 1960s Dickens separated white neighborhoods from black. But now, post-white, post-anybody with two nickels to rub together. Flight, hell lies on both sides of the street. The riverbanks are dangerous, and while standing at the crosswalk waiting for the light to change, your life can change. Some drive-by homie representing some color, clique, or any one of the five stages of grief can stick his gauge out of the passenger side window of a two-tone coupe, give you the Negro Supreme Court justice glare, and ask, "Where you from, fool?"
Do you want to talk about the obvious references there?
Not particularly, no. No, but, I mean, yeah, the references are obvious, but it's the idea of trying to unite, you know, this justice's anger with the anger of, you know, these gangbangers in this guy's neighborhood, you know, and you know, and people trying to work out their, you know, their discomfiture, their anger, their, you know, all the slights that they felt throughout history and their present life and, you know, the different ways that people cope and deal with it, you know.
Here's George in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, George. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I want to ask a question that you posed before you went to break. Is America on track about race? Personally, I don't think so. In fact, I know that America is not on point. It's Richard Pryor was one of my favorite comedians.
Yeah,
and some of the satirical jokes that he made, you know, about race, et cetera, I found very amusing and very comical. But coming from a black man's perspective at 69 years old, America has one problem. America is in denial about slavery because it is horrible and it's painful. But until this government, until this country accepts the fact that some type of restitution must be paid, as it was for the Jews, as it was for the Japanese in the internment camps, America will always be a divided nation.
George, thank you. Paul Beatty?
Yes.
What do you think? Restitution for the ills and wrongs of the past?
I mean, look, it's never going to happen. You know, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a great thing in The Atlantic about restitution. I thought he made the case about, you know, how hard it, you know, all these things about just how hard it's been, you know, he uses this family as an example of just from buying property and all these kind of things. And how do you run your life? And just, you know, this idea of the level playing field and what that is, you know. I don't even know what to say to something like that. Like, do I believe in restitution? I don't think about it that hard, to be honest, you know. I know if they send me the check, I'd cash it in a second. You know, and Chappelle did a funny thing about, you know, what would happen if it happened, you know, what would people do? And he used all the classic stereotypes of restitution basically not changing anything. You know, it's just a comedy skit, but, you know, there's, you can take a point out of it, you know. But, you know, it's the thing of, like, you know, people believe in these ideas of closure, you know, and there's no such thing, you know. And I think, you know, restitution's not going to solve the race problem, you know. And, you know, there's a ton of races in the country also, you know. And so, you know, part of it is how we talk about the race problem. You know, I'm not saying that there's a way to do it. I don't know exactly how to do it, you know. And, you know, and so, I don't know, this pops in my head right now. And, you know, people are talking about, like, furthering the discussion and putting us on the right track. And, you know, there's all these things that, you know, at some level I agree with, you know. And, you know, yeah, I don't know, when I got to college, I guess maybe late high school, you'd always hear these phrases like black empowerment and all these kind of things. And and in the book, there's a guy who's talking about these things. And he asked this question, you know, how come there aren't any black Chinese restaurants? And so, you know, and it's, I just love that phrase because it talks about so much, you know, about like who runs what in your community and what do you have a right to do and, you know, all these kind of things. And I don't know exactly what a black Chinese restaurant would be, but I would love to see one. Hmm.
What are the messages that you want people to take away from the book? African Americans, whites, what is the message that you want?
Yeah, you know, I don't have like a message. I don't have like a philosophy. It's part of the book is, you know, the guy tries to think of a motto for Black America, you know, because he helps, like, it would be easier to framework, you know, why you exist. He says this, you know, we need our own liberté, égalité, fraternité kind of thing. He tries to come up with these mottos for Black America. And so, yeah, I'm not a person who believes in messages necessarily. I mean, I hope people take away something, you know, but I think one thing is it's important to this is going to sound so corny, but I think you can say anything you want if you're considerate about it, like if it feels like you thought about it, like it doesn't feel knee-jerk. But, you know, sometimes you need to say knee-jerk things, you know, and just so, and part of that for me, it's hard to talk about this is because everybody wants this little box, this little message, this little takeaway. I don't know. What the hell do we need a takeaway for? You know, that just I just don't understand that. And for me, the way we're talking about it now is sort of counterproductive. And people who are good at talking about it in a box, in a slogan, in a soundbite, those are the people that people end up listening to because it's something for people to point at. And so that, at some level, makes the discussion easier. I don't want to say false necessarily, but it makes it easier. And so,
well, maybe the conversation continues with the reading of your book, Paul Beatty.
I hope so.
Thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Beatty's new book is The Sellout, a novel, and you can link to an excerpt from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, we'll look at President Obama's visit to Selma, Alabama, to mark the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. This is On Point. President Obama will go to Selma, Alabama tomorrow to attend a commemoration of the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, when white policemen beat demonstrators for marching for civil rights. White House correspondent Margaret Talev was in Selma this past week for Bloomberg, and she joins me now. Margaret, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
Well, thanks for taking the time. Remind us what happened in Selma 50 years ago.
Yes, indeed. Well, what you have in Selma, which is, you know, deep in the heart of the Black Belt there in Alabama, was a situation where there was severe segregation in the town and an effort by many of the blacks in Selma to register to vote, which was met with, you know, efforts to thwart the law within the boundaries of the law to just come up with last-minute tests or obstructions or tell your boss or whatever. In protest, some of the civil rights leaders, student activists, preachers in town got together and decided that they would have a march in protest, which, as everybody now knows, because it's become historic, was met with, you know, a massive physical response. The beating of blacks, the trampling of blacks with horses by law enforcement, the involvement of the Klan, Governor George Wallace's tacit approval, and what is sort of phenomenal, you know, time elapsement, you know, what happened in the weeks that followed was Martin Luther King's involvement, thousands of blacks and whites flooding to that area to do with the White House's involvement in the Johnson administration to do what became that march then with court approval from Selma to Montgomery and the pressure that forced Lyndon Johnson and the Congress to go forward with the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Mm. President Obama will be there tomorrow. He was in Selma before, right, 8 years ago?
He did. He campaigned in Selma in 2007, where he went to Brown Chapel, which was a famous staging area for the marchers on Bloody Sunday. And he spoke, you know, both about the struggle, but about the responsibilities also of the generations of black Americans that had come since to engage, to vote, to participate. There was almost kind of a scolding or a look upon yourselves element to those remarks. And when you bookend that against what has come, even just in the last couple of years, the violence in Ferguson and the sort of wave of police violence and investigations into racially motivated policing in the last year or so, it's really amazing. And I'll be really interested to see how he tempers or recalibrates those remarks. But again, even in the lead up to Selma, as he's done some of the interviews with African American radio, he has gone back a little bit to that message of 2007 and to the idea that it's not enough just to, you know, win rights and freedoms and laws and protections and laws. You have to pick up the mantle and do something with it. Mm.
So President Obama will be there, so will former President George W. Bush. Much of the congressional GOP leadership will not be there. Can you speak to that point, Margaret Telef?
Yeah, and actually, I have been surprised, I think, as have many people covering the story, about that decision. It is important for George W. Bush to be there. It's important as he looks at his own legacy. He's taken great pains as he looks back on Hurricane Katrina and on, you know, so much of the news that happened in his administration to make sure that going forward history recognizes his care and concern for black Americans. But the congressional leadership in Congress, the leadership at least, largely will not be there. There are some Republican lawmakers, including Tim Scott, the black senator from South Carolina, who do plan to go to Selma. But the apparent decision by Boehner and McConnell not to go has raised a lot of eyebrows. And there is some political backdrop to this, which is this fight now in Congress that the White House will wade into on what to do about the Voting Rights Act, how to modernize the Voting Rights Act in the wake of a Supreme Court decision that has, you know, struck down a portion of it and potentially made, you know, some of the rights and protections in the Deep South for black voters more vulnerable. There's a fight over these voter ID laws that, you know, the Democrats and the Obama administration say could set back the cause of voting rights, and that Republicans in many cases say or there's nothing wrong with asking people to show their IDs at the polls, or et cetera. So that's some of the political backdrop. But, you know, just in terms of a piece of American history and a human rights story, you know, this what happened on that bridge in Selma 50 years ago was a historic and change-causing event. And to skip it, whether intentional or unintentional, sends a signal.
You spoke to many people in Selma, Margaret Telef, White House correspondent for Bloomberg. How did they view this anniversary?
Boy, I mean, to go to Selma, it's just, it's a very emotionally charged place because many of the people who are there today are older people, stayed, were there, were either on the bridge themselves on the night of on the day of Bloody Sunday, or were on their way to the bridge, or were at the hospital, or were at the church, or they knew people who went to the bridge. And in many ways, it's a sad story, what happened to Selma, because like much of that swath of the South, it was really left behind as agriculture and manufacturing and other parts of the economy changed, as the economy is modernized, as the interstate system has built, and as the long-term and the lasting effects of segregation and the kind of clashes of the time have rippled their way through, whether it is white flight, whether it is what's happened to the schools, the brain drain just with the children of Selma and the grandchildren of Selma not being able to find the right kind of jobs and leaving for opportunities that blacks might not have had, decades earlier, but did have in bigger cities, mm-hmm. even if it's Montgomery or Birmingham, or maybe it's New York or Chicago, Los mm-hmm. Angeles, Washington. When you look at Selma, many of the younger people who are in Selma today have maybe a high school education, but not much more than that. It's very difficult for Selma to find its way out. It's very difficult for Selma to take full advantage of the gains that were made by the sacrifices on that bridge.
In your story in Bloomberg, you quote a resident who says, with all that's gone on in Selma, it should be a big tourist attraction. Like New York City, instead, buildings are closed up, run down. It should be better than that. I guess people feel that way quite strongly.
Yeah, and it's really heartbreaking when you talk to people who do feel that way. There is some thought and a little bit of evidence that all of this attention, both from the movie and the involvement of folks like Oprah Winfrey and Common, to this anniversary, President Obama's arrival there, the arrival of these airplanes full of civil rights leaders and political activists, that there will be some announcements about new funding, new money, new initiatives to help Selma. But what people in Selma think they really need is a sustained effort and something that reaches beyond kind of the press release of the day, the photo on the bridge, to go to money, to education, and to a long-term economic plan.
50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama. Margaret Talev is White House correspondent for Bloomberg. She spoke with me from Washington. Margaret, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.